Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature Margaret Atwood from September 2019. Atwood came to Portland upon the publication of her novel, The Testaments, the highly anticipated sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. We were super proud that we were able to make Portland one of only five stops on her American publicity tour. Not only is Portland's reputation as a book town key, but also Atwood and the late Ursula K. Le Guin were longtime friends, and so I do think the spirit of Le Guin was also helping us. Margaret Atwood has written over 50 works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, starting in the 1960s. She has won more prizes and awards than I have time to enumerate here. But perhaps suffice to say, Atwood's work has consistently combined an urgent engagement with the most pressing issues of our time, political, social, environmental, with a level of artistic accomplishment that is singular in the literary world. Over the span of her incredible 50-plus year career, her persistent and continued popularity speaks to the enduring relevance of her work. Atwood was in conversation with Portland writer Omar El Akkad. And there is something special about listening to a conversation between artists who are at either ends of their career. In this case, Margaret Atwood is one of our grandmasters of literary fiction and who, at the age of 80, is still producing some of her best work. Omar El Akkad is a journalist and writer and was lauded for his first novel, American War, which was published just 2 years ago. Here's El Akkad.
So how y'all doing tonight? I think we can work with that. Thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure, as always.
So I hear the new book is doing pretty well?
No. I'm Canadian, not bad. No.
For those of you who don't know, The Testaments recently broke the record for highest first-week sales in Canadian history since they started measuring. I watched a lot of previous interviews for this one, and there was one from, I think, the early 70s. It was a TVO, the public broadcaster in Ontario. And there were a number of very jarring things about this interview. You're being interviewed on TVO. One of which being that in the entirety of the studio was covered in shag carpeting for some reason. I don't know what the hell was going on in Ontario in the 70s, but
everything was covered in shag carpeting in the 70s.
It was terrifying.
The sidewalks were covered in
aesthetically irresponsible, I think. And this gentleman interviewing you repeatedly tries to get at this point of, when are you going to write nice women characters? Where is all this cruelty coming from? And finally, you say something to the effect of, like, look at what Mordecai Richler's writing. Look at his characters. Has he ever been called cruel? And I think one of the things about, I mean, you've had this incredible career that has spanned quite a long time, is the amount of uphill fighting you had to do to get to a place where it was even, where the work could be discussed as the work. And I'm wondering if you've seen changes in that, and if so, how? How has it changed?
Wow, what a topic. Well, people don't review my hair anymore, which I used to do quite a bit.
Okay. Were the initial reviews?
Is that because my hair has gotten less interesting, or because maybe they just wouldn't dare call me Medusa's snaky-haired person anymore? But they did. Yes. Where would you like to start on that? Maybe with the Time magazine interview of 1969, in which the nice reporter who was wearing white socks and loafers And it was December. He said a couple of interesting things. How do you find time to write, what with the housework and all? Oh. Whereupon I said, look under the sofa. And then he said, do men like you?
Huh.
And I said, why don't you ask them? It was a flip of the other question I used to get all the time, which was, do you like men? Which one I would say, depends which ones. They're individuals, just like people.
There was one review
that
I went
was the
to,
good old days.
I was going to say, there was one review I went back to. I went back and looked at the original reviews of The Handmaid's Tale, and there was one review that was in my I believe it was in my old paper, The Globe and Mail, and it was one of the most sort of quintessentially Canadian reviews I think I've ever read, by which I mean it was generally favorable of the book, but accused you of reaching too far.
Oh,
it was the strangest kind of Canadian-ness of like, yeah, it was a good book, but she should have set her sights lower. Which is just, it's just mind-boggling to me. Do you remember the initial sort of reception of this book?
Well, it was different from English-speaking market to English-speaking market. So In England, where they had had a religious civil war in the 17th century and weren't intending at that time to have another one, not that what's going on there right now is a religious civil war, but what would you call it? So at that time, back in the, whenever it was, 1985, they said, jolly good yarn. What an imagination. So remember that the Cold War was still going on, and Europe was very loath to think of the United States as anything but the bastion of freedom, openness, democracy, fairness for all, beckoning with open hands. That's how they actually thought of the United States, because in contrast to what was going on behind the Iron Curtain, a very shut down place. I visited it at that time. England was jolly good yarn. Europe was basically, it wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And Canada was nervously, could it happen here? In addition to, don't try so hard. yes.
Be more modest.
And in the United States, it was split. It was partly wouldn't ever happen here. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it was how long have we got? And that was in 1985.
Right.
So someone spray painted along the Venice Beach wall in California, The Handmaid's Tale is already here. Mm-hmm. And I did a talk show in San Francisco, and just to stir things up, it was a phone-in show. The guy said, well, of course, you're just joking, aren't you? I mean, nothing like that would ever happen here. And the switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree.
Are you insane?
Yes. So people knew, because it was the years of pushback against the 70s. That was already happening. Mm-hmm. And I was cutting out clippings, one cut out, then today one prints out. But I was cutting them out, and people were saying already, what they would like to do if they had the power.
Right.
So you can go read these clippings for yourself. They're in the Fisher Rare Books Library in Toronto. Mm-hmm.
I was looking at some of them. The Penguin Group published some of them. I was thinking a little bit about, I was watching this short documentary where you were talking to this interviewer, and you were talking about, I think it was Life Before Man, and you're talking about how one of the characters in that book, and I, I don't think you do this very often, but it was based on a real person. It was based on your friend's aunt, and that this aunt was such a terrible human being that you had to tone it down in the book.
I did.
Or else it wouldn't be believable.
Well, I said to my friend, can I use your aunt in my book? And she said, go ahead. She might as well be useful for something.
For something. I'm wondering if when you write something like The Handmaid's Tale or The Testaments, and you're drawing on things like Decree 770 and Communist Poland, what happened in Argentina, these events that happen to human beings, whether you ever come up on a societal or political version of the same problem, that it's just so evil.
All the time.
And what do you do?
All the time. Well, okay, so there's what is readable, and then there's what happened. So anybody who joined Amnesty International in 1970, as I did, that gave you a lot more information than you could ever use in a book. And people writing, you know, novels about war, novels about atrocities, they all have the same problem, that it's always worse in real life. It's worse and more. So if you put it all in, it would just, it would be kind of overwhelming. You get more of it in history books. So I've been reading, for some reason, I don't know why, I've been reading quite a bit about Stalingrad recently, and I've been reading Vasily Grossman's two books about Stalingrad, and there's also a history of it, which is more like a documentary, so what was actually going on. And the history is worse than what's in the novel. Because when you're in a novel, you're following individual characters. So you're not necessarily getting a pile up of information. Anyway, yeah, I think it's a problem that any novelist dealing with anything outside, shall we call it domestic drama, I think they're always going to have that problem.
There's a line in the Testaments where one of the characters says something to the effect of, you never think the sky is falling until a chunk of it falls on you. And I was curious whether you think in this moment, whether you're seeing something fundamentally new happening, or a sort of warped extrapolation of something that's always been there, or a little bit of both.
I think it's a question of time and place. So I set The Handmaid's Tale in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because that's the last place you would expect it. Or it was certainly the last place they were expecting it then. Mm-hmm. In fact, they were quite annoyed.
Yeah, Harvard was angry at you for a while.
They were peeved. Harvard doesn't get angry, they get peeved. At the beginning, they wrote kind of a peeved review. Mm-hmm. They didn't like the idea of bodies hanging on the Harvard wall, but it would be so convenient. So they've come round. Mm-hmm. But I put it there. I put many things from different times and places, and I put them there simply because it annoys me when people say it could never happen here. There's no such thing. It, whatever it is, could always happen here, wherever here is, given the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And let us not forget that Harvard started as a theological seminary in the 17th century, when the Massachusetts colony was not a democracy. Nor did it offer religious freedom. The usual story you get in school is that the Puritans came in search of religious freedom. Well, that's true, for themselves. But they were Quaker hangers. Mm-hmm. And I get to say that about them because some of them are my ancestors. Yeah.
Did Harvard finally come around? Did
they? Yes, they've come around. Yes, they've been quite nice of recent years.
That's good to hear.
But that may change once they read the Testaments. But it's just a question of repurposing of buildings. And you know that if you've traveled in particularly Eastern Europe or even the history of Paris during the German occupation, that a lot of buildings were repurposed. Mm-hmm. So this used to be the X. During the war, it was the Y, and now it's back to being a hotel.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Harvard also rejected my undergrad application, so to hell with them, you know. Good on you. I'm having such a hard time wrapping my head around the constraints, the specific constraints of writing a book like this in a moment like this. Not only the political moment, but you have this TV series that's going on at the same time that is covering similar ground. What is the interaction like? Do you shut everybody else out? Do you collaborate? How is the process of writing a book like this?
So the showrunner of The Handmaid's Tale is this person called Bruce Miller. Mm-hmm. And Bruce read The Handmaid's Tale when he was a teenager and vowed that when he grew up, he was going to do it. And he did, because he waited. The story of what happened to the TV rights is a little bit like The Hobbit, in that so the TV rights were attached to the film contract for the film that was made in 89-90. Mm-hmm. And then that film got sold to a distributor. Then the distributor went bankrupt. Then the assets were dispersed. Different people bought them. And it was lost track of who actually had them. Mm-hmm. So the ring of power went into the mountain, disappeared from view. And nobody knew that it was in there all the time. And then somebody opened a drawer, and lo and behold, it was MGM. It was like a surprise. But meanwhile, people had been saying, can we do something with this? And I would say, I don't know who has the rights. Mm-hmm. So once it was discovered that MGM had them, MGM thought that maybe they might do something with it. We're now in the present century. Mm-hmm. And when it came up, Bruce lobbied to be the showrunner, and he knew the book so thoroughly that he got the job. So he introduced himself at his first appearances about this. He would say, hi, I'm Bruce Miller, I'm the showrunner of The Handmaid's Tale, and I've got one penis too many. But but I hired a lot of women, and he did hire a lot of women. So I talk with him. I have some sort of title. I'm not sure what it is. It's executive something or other, which means something, apparently. Means something. I read the scripts. I make notes on them. I have no real power. I have influence.
Influence.
So I have influence. So I got hold of Bruce on the phone. Or he gets hold of me, and we have conversations about the notes that I have written on the scripts. Mm-hmm. And he explains if there's going to be something he's going to do that's different. He explains why. And what I said to him in this instance was, you may not kill Aunt Lydia.
That's going to be important later.
Wait, whoa, it wasn't going to. Yeah, hands off that baby. So like that. But he didn't actually read the full thing until he had done series three, because he wanted to concentrate on what he was doing. He has a writing room. Do you know what that is?
A writer's room?
Yeah, it's full of writers. Mm-hmm. And you're not allowed, nobody is allowed in, like even me. They let me in once, but it was before they'd written anything on the whiteboards which surround the rooms.
I mean, they've let you do a cameo. Is that
you, let you, me do that?
I'm sorry. That is
of course me do.
They knew better than to not let you do a cameo.
No, they knew. They knew what a ham I was, and they offered me a cameo.
So this happens in a church gymnasium, I believe, where they shoot this thing?
Yeah, they actually shot it in the cellar of a church.
So you're in this cellar, there's cameras everywhere. Your job is to essentially walk up and slap Elizabeth Moss.
No, I give her a bop on the back of the head.
So they're repeatedly having to reshoot this scene because you're not hitting her hard
enough.
That's
correct, and they added a sound effect.
I'm just curious, how often in your life do you look around and just say, how the hell did I get here? Like, how this is such a surreal moment to go from this novel that you wrote 30-some years earlier to be in this place making a cameo in the new TV series about what is the best-selling novel in the world 34 years earlier. How surreal is that moment?
The older you get, the less surreal everything seems. Because you have seen the definition of normal change so much that, you know, this is surreal, and so is this. And here comes something else that's surreal. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the whole period of history in which we live is pretty much surreal, and it's certainly very unusual compared to, say, 19, pick a year. Mm-hmm. Let's pick 1995, a nice safe year. I don't think much was going on then, except shopping. The Cold War was over, and it was the end of history, we were informed by somebody who wasn't thinking very hard. And everybody felt that, you know, what you wore was really the most important thing. That has changed.
There's this thing I think William Gibson said about this notion that the future is here, but it's just not evenly distributed.
And he was right about that, yeah. But it's when it arrives in a big surreal lump that you think these are strange times.
There's that element of, I mean, there's in my mind anyway, there's certain books that belong to the pantheon of sort of speculative fiction of this kind. There's Brave New World, 1984, there's The Handmaid's Tale. That one of the things they all have in common is this notion that the warning they give is not heeded, and that's part of their longevity. If people actually listened to what these books had to say and did something differently, that it would affect the longevity of the book.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, you write a book like that hoping it will shortly be obsolete. Mm-hmm. That's what you hope. And for a while, it is, you know, things come and go. So for a while, I would say, we used to have a kind of race going on, and the race was which is going to get here first, Brave New World or 1984. Mm-hmm. And now I think we've got a combination of both of them. But for a while it looked, in the 90s it looked as if Brave New World was winning. Yeah, but it didn't.
Do you remember where you were when watching election night? Do you remember what the circumstances were?
No, which election night are we talking about?
The only one that has ever been, it feels like these days. November 2016.
Well, I was on a plane. Huh. Yeah, so I was on a plane going to Europe, so I went to bed on the plane thinking that, I don't know, I had seen their closing speeches on television. And having grown up next door to Marshall McLuhan, there's some people who have very good television presentation, mm-hmm. and other people who don't. Whatever you may say about him, Donald Trump has a television manner. Mm-hmm. Like he looks as because he's had a lot of practice at it. So I was feeling a bit iffy. But then I woke up in another country in the morning, and I and everybody involved in the Handmaid's Tale series had the same thought. And the thought was, we are now in a different show. Mm-hmm. Not that anything about the show was going to change. The frame had changed, and it would be viewed differently. And that is what happened.
What stage of the process of writing this book were you at?
I was at the conceptual note-making waste basket stage. Where you say, how about this? No. Well, maybe this? No. Like that. So that goes on quite a bit.
I wanted to ask, and this is a complete tangent, and I apologize. There's a half sentence in this book that I absolutely loved. It's describing lunch, and it's the person talking describes lunch as something like a dry sandwich and something ruinous that had been done to tomatoes. And it made me think of a line that I'd heard you say this in one of your interviews, that there are essentially two types of writers. There are writers who let their characters eat, and there are writers who don't let their characters eat. And as I'm going through the sensory experience of reading this book, I was thinking about that. I'm just wondering, is the process of writing, is there a joy in that, or is the joy in having written? Where's the most joyous part of the process?
Where's the fun?
Where's the fun?
Yeah, okay. I would say the fun is for me, the fun is in writing, no matter what the content. Mm-hmm. So definitely. I once did a book called it was a fundraiser. We were raising money to start Canadian Pen. Mm-hmm. Pen being the writers' rights organization, which is international. There's now a very effective American Pen. So we needed some money to start it, and I put together something called the Can Lit Food Book, in which I took scenes from novels and poems in which people ate things, and I arranged them according to the meal, so breakfast, you know, coffee, lunch, tea, dinner, funerals, cannibalism, like that. And I did that. I illustrated it myself because it was cheaper. And then I went to the authors and got recipes from them. Some could cook, others could not cook. But they gave me recipes anyway. So one of them gave me a recipe for toast. If you put the oven on toast, you push the button. And Michael Ondaatje gave me a recipe for grapefruit. You cut the grapefruit too.
Grapefruit. Works out.
Yeah, and somebody else gave me one that which involved a large frozen fish and a chainsaw.
I don't even remember what the hell I was asking you about to begin with. This is the best interview I've ever been a part of. I was going through your website, and there's a couple of really interesting things about it, one of which being that when you click on awards, the first thing the website asks you is pick a decade, so you can't possibly fit everything on one page. But there's so many works across such a broad spectrum. The most read Margaret Atwood book in our house is Up in the Tree, which I believe...
You must have some small children.
You would hope so.
To explain to everybody who may not have read this deathless work, it is a book for very small children, which came early on in the history of Canadian publishing. There weren't children's books being published in the 70s, so I wrote it, I lettered it because it was cheaper, and I illustrated it, but we could only afford two colors for the printing, rather than the customary three. So I chose the blue and the red, which together gave this weird shade of purple. Mm-hmm. And that is why that book is the colors that it is.
And this was in the 70s.
Yeah.
I was asked by my two-year-old, why did they go up in the tree in the first place?
That is a very good question.
It is.
Tell the two-year-old, because they didn't have a real house.
I think that'll
suffice.
That'll
do. Yeah. Safer from bears.
Is there any project that comes along that initially you think, this is just far too weird, and then you change your mind on? Curiosity gets the better of you?
Constantly. Yeah, well, you mean that comes into my head. So usually what happens with those is I think this is far too weird, And I try to do something more, quotes, normal, mm-hmm. which then fails. Mm-hmm. So that is the unconscious telling you that you have to write the weird thing. Mm-hmm. That would be The Handmaid's Tale. I started my notes on it in 1981, and then I thought, this is far too weird. And I set out to write this more usual type of novel, which went nowhere. Mm-hmm.
Is there a place you keep the ones that go nowhere and you know it's going to stay there, you're not going to go back to it?
It's called a drawer.
Is the drawer full or empty or somewhere in
between?
There
are a couple of drawers. Mm-hmm. So it's not because my parents went through the Depression. Mm-hmm. You never threw anything out because it might come in handy. So big balls of string. It's like the drawer.
As I was reading an essay where you talk about the first literary conference you ever went to as a teenager. And at one point you talk about the first writer who ever came to your high school, who was this gentleman who came up on stage, recited a few poems about skiing from memory, and then imitated a crow.
Yeah, that made quite an impression.
I imagine. Yeah. And then you talk about how you never want to be in that position, and the line you use is something like, as soon as I was able, I was going to hit Paris and become incomprehensible.
That was the days of existentialism. Yeah, that's.
It's also the new line I use whenever I leave a room right now. So, peace out. I'm going to go to Paris and become incomprehensible.
Yes, it was in Paris that a literary person said to me in a sneering tone, "So you write the bestsellers?" And I said, "Not on purpose."
Well, there was a time when you had decided you wanted to become a journalist, and then your family brought along a second cousin who was a journalist to try dissuade you from this.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did they ever try to do the same when you said, okay, I'm going to write literary fiction? Did they ever bring someone to
well,
try
to Well, we didn't have the term literary fiction then, mm-hmm. dear.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Nobody had invented that yet. It was just called books, you know. Yeah, which is probably why I don't, you know, I don't think it's genre over here and real books over here. I mm-hmm. just think it's good books and other books. So, yeah, those were the days. And what the second cousin said, because this was the 50s, he said, well, yes, you can write for newspapers, but if you do write for newspapers, you will be writing the ladies' pages and the obituaries. Mm-hmm. So that put me off that. Some unkind critics may have said that that's what I've been doing anyway, but mm-hmm. never mind. Yeah. So then I was going to, what was I going to do then? I did have a period when I was going to write, I got something called writer's markets. And I looked in the back where it said what you got paid, because that's what writer's markets was. And what you got paid the most for was true romance stories. So I thought, I can do this. Wrong. And you got paid the most for those. So I was going to write those in the daytimes, and then I was going to write my deathless works of literature in the evenings. But that plan did not go anywhere because I was not good at writing the true romance stories. I was okay with the plots. Those were quite simple. Mm-hmm. The guy with the motorcycle, the other one who works in the shoe store, wrong choices are made, things happen on the sofa. Which were in those days described with rows of dots. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do the dots. So mm-hmm. I just could not bring myself. Yeah, so then I was going to, what was I going to do? I was going to go, I really was going to go to Paris and live in a garret, learn to smoke. Wrong, I never could do that. drink absinthe, get TB. And no, as one does.
As one does, yes.
Yes.
A while back, I was going to Guantanamo Bay to cover the military trials, and I was really scared because, you know, this guy named Omar going to Guantanamo Bay, right?
Yeah. Were you not tempted to change your name?
I've often been, mostly at TSA lines at the airport is when that temptation comes up. But then the CBC decides to send a cameraman named Osama. So suddenly all the pressure is off. So anyway, the story's going somewhere, I promise. Not anywhere particularly good, but it's going somewhere. And so at one night, Osama and I are wandering around Camp Justice, which is the tent city where they keep the reporters, and we find the rec tent, which has, you know, a checkers board, and it happens to have this ping pong table. And Osama says, "Do you want to play some ping pong?" I say, "Sure, whatever." So we start playing. It turns out, very quickly, I discover that Osama was an alternate on the Egyptian Olympic ping pong team. So very quickly, I'm now using the paddle for protection more than anything else. And if occasionally the ball should go back across the net, then great, he gets to, you know, hit it behind his back or something. And I was thinking a lot about that going into this interview.
Well, I'm a terrible ping pong player.
It is, sorry, we're jumping all over the place. It is a really spectacular book, and it moves with this incredible velocity. And it moves on space that for me as a reader is sacred space. I mean, The Handmaid's Tale was a book that made a huge difference in my life. And there's always a sense of trepidation when you see, even the TV show, you see this thing and you think, as I think is this kind of selfish reaction from readers, this is mine. You know, don't you know? Don't you know that this is? But it's this book that moves in such an incredible way. And I'm wondering, when you're writing it, do you have, because this is predominantly told from the point of view of three people. The vast majority of the book is from these three points of view. But it very much switches sides and lets you know what happens in this place. Was that there from the get-go when you decided to go back and write this sequel?
Yes.
And is it, so you go there, and then do you sort of, what changes the most in terms of your initial conception versus the final product?
Whoa. Okay. Some characters were easier to write than others. So one of them I really had to take several runs at it. And if you're a novel writer, you will know that one of the most important things to deal with is the structure of the book. So there's the plot, what happens, and then there's the structure of the book, how you tell what happens and in what order. But that's just, you know, those are craft matters. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a first reader, or who gets to see it first?
This one was a very unusual set of circumstances, because from the get-go, sinister forces were trying to steal it. Huh. And what they were going to do with it, I'm told, is they were going to put it up online and get people to give them their credit card information. Mm-hmm. So it was going to be used as a phishing lure. So we were going through all sorts of special drop boxes and passwords and all of this kind of thing to prevent this from happening. So ordinarily I would have had several readers that aren't in the business. Mm-hmm. So outside readers. And I like to have that because they represent readers. So they don't have any skin in the game. Mm-hmm. So I depend on them usually to tell me the truth. This time we had a group of editors from three different countries, and those were the first readers. And they remained the only readers for quite a while because they were so afraid of this leaking. And I would have felt terrible if a lot of people's financial information had been removed from them and used in evil ways to deprive them of their money.
The same publishing house people were telling me that they've never had as many hacking attempts.
It
in
was
the history
incessant.
Of the company.
It was amazing, but it was letters that purported to be from people inside the industry.
Huh.
But if you looked at the email address, it might be just one letter different from a real email address. So they were very cleverly done. Mm-hmm.
The conditions under which you wrote this book, it wasn't written in one place.
It was not.
Is that the norm for you, or
it is?
You wrote part of it on a train?
I wrote part of it in a dome car.
Hmm.
Yeah. Why is that? We won as a door prize a trip across Canada on Via Rail.
Mm-hmm.
So there we were going across Canada on Via Rail. There's a lot of Canada. You know, there's a lot of it.
Quite a bit.
Yes, the unofficial national anthem is a song called Canada's Really Big. It's by a group called the Arrogant Worms. You can find it on YouTube. So there was actually quite a lot of time and space to do this, and you can write quite well in the dome car with your laptop propped up on your knees, and every once in a while you can have a scenic view.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can have another scenic view, and then you can have
and then you hit the prairies, and it's 40 hours of the same thing.
It's more rapid across the prairies.
Yeah.
You sort of go quite fast. But then you go up through the Rocky Mountains, you wind up and up and up and up and up and down and down and
your relationship with technology is fascinating to me. You have somewhere in the, I don't know how many million Twitter followers at this point, but do you remember how you first embraced that technology?
I don't think embrace is quite the word. Learned about. So yes, I was building a website for a novel of mine called The Year of the Flood. And it was just after the big financial meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I think I better do this because the publishers are running around screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And they're fewer in number than they once were. So I actually built a website for that book and did a launch that was a musical and dramatic. And conservation fundraising launch. It was peculiar. But it lent itself to that because in the Year of the Flood there are a number of God's Gardeners hymns, so we could have a music in it,
mm-hmm.
which we did. And the people building the website said, you need to have a Twitter feed. And I said, what is that? And they said, oh, it's this new thing. It's really easy. We will show you how to do it. So I actually had a Twitter coach, a guy called McLean Greaves. He is unfortunately no longer with us, but he was an early Twitter user, and he knew quite a lot about it, and he helped get rid of the four other people who were purporting to be me.
Huh. And
they were tweeting these really soppy things that I would never tweet. I mean, they weren't being unpleasant, but they were being very sugary.
Huh.
And so it could not be. They had to go.
What's the ratio of sort of positive Twitter experiences versus the guy who came on to try and explain The Handmaid's Tale to you in your replies?
Well, I don't consider that a negative experience. I consider it a learning experience. for him. But I think his intentions were of the best. He just didn't happen to realize that I had written it, which is a bit embarrassing. I think mostly positive for me, because I just don't... I've gotten into a few what are called flame wars, but not very many.
Is there a new generation of readership that has engaged with you primarily through that medium?
I don't know, because I can't ask each and every one of them, how did you come to this book? I think, quite frankly, a lot of them have been introduced to my work in high school, because it gets to be a set text. Yeah. And I was kind of horrified by that when I first found out about it, because I thought that, you know, this is a pretty rough book in some ways, and surely these young people might be too young for it, but apparently not. And then I think of what I was reading when I was that age, and yes, okay, they can read it.
I've been handed a card that simply says Q&A, which means that it's your turn. I think what we're going to do, excuse me, I think what we're going to do, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, is we're going to take questions on note cards. So write them, hand them out to the ushers who are going to be going down the aisles. I have some here, we'll get some more and we'll get to it.
That's you've already got quite a few.
These were just the emailed ones. And there's going to be more. What is your favorite Ursula K. Le Guin story or novel?
Well, quite a few of them, but I'm quite partial to the Earthsea trilogy. Yeah. Yeah, I understand it's a different kind of book from The Left Hand of Darkness, which I'm also pretty keen on. I did a retrospective piece about her for the New York Review of Books a while back, in which I go through some of these books, but also this burst of creativity that she had. She wrote those very close together. They're quite it's quite amazing.
This is signed A Young Writer. Dear Margaret, how do you silence your inner critic?
Okay, here is how. Nobody is going to see what you write on your pieces of paper unless you allow them to. So just do it. That inner critic should not be in the room with you when you are doing that writing. The inner critic can come along later when you're revising. But when you're first writing, it's just you, it's the page, it's the ideal reader, and you can always throw it out if you don't like it.
This is a question about the Future Library Project in which you're involved, which is absolutely such a brilliant idea. What is it like to write a novel that won't be read for 100 years?
Okay, so first I'll tell you about the Future Library of Norway Project, which you can find online, futurelibrary.no. And it's the brainchild of a conceptual artist called Katie Patterson, who is Scottish. And she works with slow time projects. So the Future Library of Norway, a forest has been planted in Norway that will grow for 100 years. And in each year of that 100 years, a different writer from around the globe in different languages will submit a secret manuscript, two copies only, and nobody else gets to read it. And it has to be made of words, no images. So it can be a word, it can be a poem, it can be a novel, it can be a short story, it can be a diary, it can be a letter, it can be anything made of words, and you're not allowed to tell what it is. You can tell the title and the name of the author. That's it. In the 100th year, the boxes will all be opened and enough trees will be cut from the forest that will have grown to make the paper to print the future Library of Norway. And when we launched this in 2014, it got a lot of interest because it's such a hopeful project. It assumes there will be a Norway, that the trees will have grown, there will be a library, there will be people. The people will be able to read, and the people will be interested in reading. And that's just one great, big, huge ball of hope right there. So what was it like? I think there are two kinds of writers, the kind that would say, are you out of your mind? I'm not going to write anything I can't publish now. And then there's the other kind who has children buried things in jars in the backyard, and that would be me. Just thinking that maybe somebody in the future would get a thrill out of digging them up. So I've always been interested in archaeology. And I'm quite thrilled whenever somebody discovers a new something or other that they've dug up. So I said yes immediately, and I said there's something you need to add to this mix, and that would be archival paper, because otherwise they'll open the box and it will be just little shreds like my copy of South Pacific right now. It's just completely decayed. So I took it on. And what was it like to do it? Well, it's like writing in general. It's just that the interval is somewhat longer. So when you're writing anything, there's always a gap between you writing it and somebody else reading it. That's just the way writing is. It's not like being an opera singer in which the audience and the person doing the art are in the same place at the same time. So with writing, you're always in a different place, in a different time. So other than that, Katie wanted the whatever you wrote to have something to do with time and something to do with words. That's the only constraint. The other constraint was that you have to go to Norway with this box.
So, and go through customs or something.
Well,
and not
yeah,
allowed to...
so I was afraid they were going to say, what's in the box? And then I would have to say, I'm not allowed to tell you that. Then I would get arrested.
I could not think of a better question to end on. What is your favorite bird and place to go birding?
My favorite bird is probably either the raven, the most intelligent of birds, or the loon, the most haunting of bird sounds. Do you want a sample? No, you don't.
Please.
Okay, we'll just do the eerie call that echoes through the twilight. When one loon is trying to contact another loon and goes, ooh.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Margaret Atwood.
That was Margaret Atwood from a Literary Arts special event in September 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More on colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.